Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you are tuned into WPFW, Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
President Trump is losing more cases in court than he's winning. But is it too early for critics to take a victory lap? And how to talk to your son about fascism. Author Craig A. Johnson joins us with Blueprint, and you should too. Good morning, good morning, good morning, and welcome to What's at Stake. I am Verna Avery Brown. Well, minutes after Trump was sworn into office, lawsuits began flooding the courts. According to Bloomberg, a publication that supports both progressive and conservative causes, President Trump faced at least 328 lawsuits as of May 1st, and he's losing a lot more decisions than he's winning. But is it too early for Trump critics to take a victory lap? Do these lower court victories against Trump amount to little more than speed bumps to his agenda? And can Trump and his legal team appeal many of these decisions to the U.S. Supreme Court, where his conservative stacked justices will likely acquiesce to his wishes? After all, it was this court that granted him broad immunity for official acts, essentially placing the president above the law. Joining us this morning to help sort out this legal quagmire is attorney Alicia Bannon. Bannon is the director of the Judiciary Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, where she works to realize a fair and inclusive judicial system that protects fundamental rights, democratic values, and the rule of law. An experienced constitutional lawyer and expert on the courts and access to justice in the legal system, Bannon leads a team of lawyers and researchers engaged in policy advocacy, litigation, legislative campaigns, research and analysis, and public education. Good morning, Attorney Bannon, and thank you for joining us this morning on What's at Stake.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start by saying, as an experienced constitutional lawyer and many years of work at the Brennan Center to preserve our democracy and protect our fundamental rights like the rule of law, what are your thoughts about the manner in which the Trump regime has ignored the rule of law, attempted to reinterpret one of the basic tenets of the Constitution, and threatened to jail judges who issue rulings they don't like? Of course, the left is appalled at these actions, but in fact, he's not the first U.S. president to test these powers. President Nixon was no Boy Scout. Nixon was known for his executive abuse of power, even at times threatening the freedoms of speech, press, and political association. So how do you, Attorney Bannon, view Trump in this historical perspective?
That's such an important question. And I think that we are in a very scary moment of democratic backsliding. We're seeing the president threaten the rule of law in a number of ways, issue a number of executive orders that are plainly lawless. I also think we are seeing the judicial branch of government really step up in this moment as a real bulwark for the rule of law. A professor recently crunched some numbers and found that there were 97 different cases so far where federal trial courts have issued some kind of an order against the administration, that 73 different judges, 25 different judicial districts across the country, and critically appointed by seven different presidents, including some judges appointed by President Trump in his first term. So I think what we've been seeing is not a partisan or political response on the part of the courts. We've actually really seen the courts, a wide array of judges with a wide array of perspectives on the law, really stand up for the rule of law in this moment. And unfortunately, we're also seeing real pushback from the administration with respect to failures to respect court orders and suggestions that maybe court orders could be optional. We've seen threats to impeach judges. We've seen a whole array of verbal assaults. And we've seen that play out then in judges receiving threats. There's been a whole trend of dozens of judges getting pizza delivered to their homes by people basically sending a message, "We know where you live." And so it's a very scary time, I think, for these courts at the same time that they're, I think, playing a very important role in upholding the rule of law.
Well, they're stepping up, as you say, and they've won a number of cases. Well, they've led the Trump administration to lose a number of cases. But is that enough? Because can't they continue to appeal these cases to the Supreme Court, where we have no idea what the outcome will be, and we have a reason to suspect that it may be in Trump's favor?
So absolutely. The way our system works when cases are filed is, generally speaking, they first go to a trial court, and those trial courts do typically have power to issue emergency relief, fast-moving relief to block administration actions, protect the interests of people who are going to court to protect their rights. But then typically those measures can be appealed. And so those go up to intermediate courts and then can ultimately go up to the Supreme Court. And there's a lot we don't know yet about exactly how the Supreme Court is going to respond in this moment. I think the early signs are really mixed. There have been some instances, like around the efforts to deport individuals to El Salvador under this wartime statute, the Alien Enemies Act, where you saw the Supreme Court initially put up various hurdles, lots of procedural steps, things like that, really was trying to punt doing anything about that case. More recently, the court has been a little more aggressive in saying, hold on, we're not reaching the big questions yet, but we're gonna make sure that these people have the right to due process, that they're actually having a chance to make their claims and not just getting shunted off where the Trump administration at least is claiming that there's nothing they can do at that point. And so there's some places where I think the court has been signaling that it's going to make sure that the judicial process can proceed as it should. In other places, the signs are much more worrying. So also recently there was a case where on the court's shadow docket, and it's emergency docket, it was considering the firing of various heads of independent agencies like the National Labor Relations Board. And there, the Supreme Court, not actually reaching the merits of the case, said, okay, but for now, those people can be fired, and kind of suggested that they're going to make a very significant change to the law to give the president a lot more power to fire heads of independent agencies. And that's both been a long-term conservative project, but also a very scary time for that to be coming into effect. I think right now we're seeing exactly the dangers of a project that gives overwhelming power concentrated solely in the president in that way.
Well, you know what worries me, Attorney Bannon, is the fact that the Trump administration basically has given the middle finger to the court in a lot of ways, because the court instructed them specifically to facilitate the return of one person that was deported to El Salvador, and they haven't done it. And, you know, in the long run, the bottom line is the court really can't enforce them to do anything. They don't have enforcement powers, but we're going to talk about that a little later. Let's talk about the immunity clause the high court granted Trump. It strikes me as a get-out-of-jail-free card, or in fact, he would never even have to go to jail, no matter what he does while in office. Is that a correct interpretation of that law, or is that an overstatement?
I think the immunity decision that the Supreme Court issued last year, it was one of the worst decisions in the court's history. I think it's actually a decision that's going to live in infamy. I think it does give the president pretty broad criminal immunity when the president claims that their actions are official. So it doesn't mean the president can do anything, but kind of within the bounds of the president's official, quote unquote, official actions, it opens the door to wide lawlessness and wide abuses of power. And also, coupled with the president's ability to issue pardons to people, it essentially sets up a roadmap for how the president, working within his administration, could have wide lawlessness with virtually no potential culpability. And so I do think it's an extremely dangerous opinion. I think it was a wild opinion in that this is a court that purports to be an originalist court that embraces history. And I think one of the things that's clearest from our history was that we didn't want a king. And so the notion that our Constitution would open up that level of broad immunity for the president just is wildly ahistorical and extremely dangerous.
So would it take a constitutional amendment, or is there anything that can be done to reverse that that immunity clause?
Well, I think it remains to be seen exactly how the court's ruling would be interpreted and applied under particular factual scenarios. So the way the court typically operates is it writes in broad language, and then there's a lot of fighting around the details. And so I think certainly one path would be a constitutional amendment. There are potentially at least narrow ways that there could be responses by Congress as well. And then I think there's also questions just as if there were criminal prosecutions brought down the line, I think that courts would fight out what those details are. And maybe there would even be pressure on the Supreme Court to revisit the scope of its opinions, right? The court, as we've seen in recent years, does revisit precedents. And so I think another question would be, would there be pressure on the court to revisit and maybe cabin those decisions going forward.
So Trump's deportation practices appear to be flagrant violations of our constitutional right to due process, of the right to defend oneself against charges in a court of law. People are dragnetted literally off the streets of America and deported to a gulag in a foreign country, El Salvador. And the Trump administration thus far basically thumbed its nose at the Supreme Court order to facilitate the return of one of those individuals. If they're blowing off a Supreme Court order, what, if anything, can be done to rein in the administration?
So there have been now several examples of the administration failing to follow court orders. So you've had multiple trial court judges make those findings. One judge, this was the case involving these rushed deportations under the Alien Enemies Act to El Salvador, where the judge said, if they're in the air, you need to turn around that plane. And the administration did not turn around that plane. And that's how Mr. Abrego-Garcia and others ended up in El Salvador, was that order was not followed. And, you know, that judge found that there was probable cause for criminal contempt. I think in terms of what the tools are, there are a set of legal tools that courts have. And I think we're seeing those operate now. Courts can... First, one step they can take is with the orders that they're giving, they make them more specific. They hold the government on a shorter leash. Ultimately, they can find the government in contempt of court. And that has happened in the past, that government officials have been found in contempt of court.
And what would happen if they are? If they're found in contempt of court, then what?
Well, so their contempt can have various consequences. Financial consequences, even jail penalties, as ways to try to enforce compliance. Now, ultimately, if you had a true confrontation, and we haven't reached that point yet, where the administration was found in contempt and just simply refused to respond, obstructed the operation of contempt, then I think we would be entering a new level of constitutional crisis. I think in terms of what that means, we have to think about institutions beyond the court. I think the courts have been doing a really important job in helping to uphold the rule of law, but they can't do it on their own. And I think at that point, you need public outcry, you need Congress to do its job, you need other institutions, you need the business community, you need the labor community, you really need everyone to step up and say, our constitutional democracy can't work without the rule of law and without court orders being followed. And that if we reach those levels of defiance, I think we need to have that kind of broad public response so that there's enough pressure that the administration recognizes that it needs to comply with court orders.
Okay. So the court system itself has no enforcement power over the executive branch. So even if conservative justices basically grow a pair and ruled that he needed to return the man immediately, and Trump's lawyers argued that the court cannot circumvent the president's power to carry out the will of the people, which is what they tend to argue. And they argued that the people elected Trump to deport illegal immigrants. What could be done to check Trump? I guess we just touched upon some of that. But who's going to check him, Boo? That's the question that I think I've been wondering for quite some time.
Look, our system is a system of checks and balances. It works best when all of our institutions are performing the checks and balances that we need to. I would say it remains to be seen the extent to which the Supreme Court rises to this moment. It is certainly the case that our lower courts have been playing a very significant job as an institutional bulwark. We haven't been seeing that from Congress. Congress hasn't been playing the critical role we need it to play. There are other checks in our system, though. So, for example, when we talk about checks and balances, one place that I think people often don't think about is the role of the states. So we also are a federal system. And so states can also play a really important role as a check and balance as well. And we've seen that in litigation. So many of the lawsuits that have been brought against the Trump administration have been brought by state attorneys general. So states have been in the courtroom actually seeking to hold the administration to account when violating the laws in ways that are impacting states and their citizens. There's also state laws, state constitutional protections that can be a counterbalance sometimes and fill voids when you have the national government stepping back and not protecting certain rights. So, for example, there has been the administration has been targeting hospitals providing gender-affirming care. And you've seen a number of state attorney generals step up and say, hey, hospitals, we have state laws and state civil rights protections that are at play here. So you can't just kind of stop treating people, be risk averse because you don't want to attract the attention of the administration, because our state laws apply too. So I think another thing we need to look at and make sure that we're holding our state and local officials to account on is to make sure that we're also leaning on state civil rights protections and other state provisions that can provide protections to people as well.
Well, that's something to look forward to and to be, you know, be considered in this whole scenario. I would imagine it would take a constitutional amendment to give the Supreme Court enforcement powers, though, wouldn't it, Attorney Bannon? Has there been any discussion about doing that ever?
Well, I think it depends on what you mean by enforcement power. So courts do have tools like their contempt power, like sanctions of attorneys. They can make the government's job very difficult and make it very hard for the government to operate in court if they're not complying by court orders. So courts do have tools to enforce their orders. And those can include things like financial penalties and other incentives to try to encourage good behavior. They can also include limits on litigation. So you might say the government can't even raise certain arguments in litigation because of misbehavior in those cases. So there are things that courts can do, but ultimately our system does rely on all of our different branches of government operating in good faith. And so the court doesn't have an army. It doesn't have the power of the purse, right? Those are other branches of government. And so there are going to be limits on what the court can do because the way our system is designed, it's not an executive branch. It's not a legislative branch. It's the role that the court's supposed to play. The job of judges is to interpret the law. And we have a system of checks and balances because the idea is it's better to separate those jobs so you have an independent body that's assessing the law that's not also applying it.
And, you know, the part where you said that the court does not have, you know, doesn't own a military or can't, that's the executive branch controls the military. So if, say, for example, the court ordered, held somebody in contempt of court and they were to be arrested, the executive branch, could they not just step in and say, oh, no, we're not going to do that? And the reason to me that's important is because when asked if Trump had to uphold the Constitution in an interview on, I forget which news agency, I think it might have been CBS, Trump said, I don't know. I have a team of brilliant lawyers. So he never really committed to, you know, upholding the Constitution. So, I mean, I don't know. That's the part that worries me. I think you're a little bit more optimistic about this than I am, because it seems like it's a toothless tiger, the Supreme Court. The whole system really is based on an honor system. Everybody has to agree to play by the rules. And Trump, already we know, doesn't play by the rules.
Well, I think that's where it's so important to have public pressure and to have shows like this where we're talking about these issues and to make sure that people are really paying attention to what's going on. You mentioned Nixon at the start of the show, and Nixon had suggested at times that maybe he didn't need to follow court orders. And if the president does it, it's allowed. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the Supreme Court spoke strongly that, in fact, there were fights about what the president had to turn over and the like. And the Supreme Court said, you have to do X, Y, and Z. And there was enough public outcry. There was pressure from Congress. And Nixon ultimately acknowledged that he did need to comply with those court orders. And ultimately, that led to a whole series of events that led to his ultimate resignation. But that was not a foregone conclusion. I think that came from political pressure around recognizing the importance of the rule of law and backing the court up. And so I think, and there have been other instances, President Bush, he ultimately, in the middle of the Iraq war and with all of the, you know, pressure that, you know, all of the things he was pushing for, ultimately there were court orders around Guantanamo detainees. He said, I don't like what the court said, but I recognize that I have to follow it. Even in going all the way back to President Truman, we were in another war, and he had tried to nationalize the steel industry. And the Supreme Court, you said, you had to strike it, you have to shut that down. And he followed those court orders. And I think in all of those instances, we've seen there's a long tradition of presidents ultimately recognizing that they have to comply with court orders. And I think what we need to do as the public is really hold the president to account of that tradition and put that public pressure on him so that he recognizes that this isn't an optional decision.
And I think in those instances, you had a Congress that was willing to put pressure on those presidents. And that's something that's absent from today's scenario. But let's go on. So why should Americans who are not immigrants themselves and who don't know any immigrants and really kind of want the illegal immigrants deported, why should they be concerned about how the Trump administration is ignoring the rule of law? Trump has said more prisons should be built for the quote unquote homegrown prisoners to be deported. What's the threat there, Attorney Bannon?
Well, I think the rule of law and due process protects everybody. And if you think about it, if you don't have due process, if you don't have a chance to go to a court and say, this is how the law and facts apply to me, if you don't actually have the chance to make that case, then you might be impacted even if the law doesn't apply to you. And we've seen instances of that, like Mr. Abrego Garcia, who by all accounts, it was a mistake that he was sent to El Salvador, but he never had an opportunity to make that case. And that implicates all of us. And more generally speaking, we have so many laws in our country, and the federal government has so much power. It has so much prosecutorial power. I think it's so important for us to realize that without those safeguards and protections, that could implicate any one of us. And so I think it's something where we really need to think of it not as what did any particular person do or not, but making sure we have a system where we can see the law and the facts being applied to each person to make make sure that it's being done fairly. And if it's not, that could implicate anybody, regardless of whether they are a citizen or a non-citizen, or whether or not they did whatever the allegation is in a particular case.
So when you heard him say that about homegrown prisoners possibly being deported to foreign prisons, what was your reaction to that?
I mean, I think that would be wildly illegal for many reasons. We have an Eighth Amendment to our Constitution that protects against cruel and unusual punishment. And there's other statutory, there's a lot of legal structures in place that would bar that kind of action. And so I think that's just another example of why we need to make sure we have the rule of law operating, so that we don't have some dynamic where people get swept away without being able to protect their rights and point to constitutional protections or laws that say, no, you can't do that.
Okay, so is Trump violating the Constitution's emollient clause by accepting that $400 million gift jet from Qatar? And since the GOP-led Congress refuses to hold him accountable, is there anything citizens can do about it? I mean, you've spoken about scandals on the high court involving Justices Alito and Thomas and improper gifts that they took. How likely is it that the high court could hold Trump accountable? You spoke about it in other interviews that I saw.
Yeah, well, so I think with respect to the specifics of the jet, the facts have kept changing. And so I think it depends a lot on exactly what was agreed to, and is it a gift to him? Is it a gift to the administration? What's going to happen? But I think the broader question of can the court, or and in what ways will the court be hemming in corruption and other kinds of abuses of power? I think it's certainly a concern. The court's jurisprudence around any kind of money and politics regulation or the like is very poor. I think stepping back and talking about how we got to the moment we are in right now, I think you can trace a whole long line of cases around democracy issues, like opening the door to flood of money in politics, weakening voting rights protections, opening the door to partisan gerrymandering. There's a whole bunch of different cases over the past 15 years or so where the court has really chipped away, sometimes with a hammer, really key democracy protections in our system. And so I think when we're talking about the importance of the public stepping up and accountability, one of the real hurdles to that is that the Supreme Court has made it harder for people to operate in our democratic system effectively. And so I certainly think that's a place where the Supreme Court has to be held accountable, right, for helping bring us to a moment where a lot of our democratic institutions are weakened.
Hmm. So and so, what is the real danger in accepting those type of gifts? Why did the forefathers include that emollient clause in the Constitution? That does it really pose a threat to our security as a country, as a nation?
Well, certainly, I think there were real concerns about presidents, especially at the time of the founding, right? Like there were a lot of worries that this was a new country. There were a lot of connections to foreign governments. There were real concerns. This was that there could be manipulation, et cetera. And so I think very much our constitutional founders were worried about presidents being too closely tied to foreign governments, and that raising real security concerns for the country.
Mm-hmm. And so finally, tell us about how the Brennan Center is attacking some of these challenges that the Trump administration is posing.
Well, so the Brennan Center is a think tank and advocacy organization dedicated to strengthening and improving our systems of government. And so we're engaged in a whole bunch of different ways. We are in the courtroom. We've been organizing a lot of friend of the court briefs in a lot of cases as they're making their way up to appellate courts and ultimately the Supreme Court, trying to make sure that things like these like the history that informed the creation of our Constitution and other important considerations are before the court, so that they have all that context when they're making these decisions. We've also been active in protecting voting rights and making sure that we don't see our system weakened or undermined, and making sure that we have a free and fair election in 2026 and 2028. So we're kind of working in the immediate moment, and then we're also working to make sure that we have a strong and fair democracy going forward.
And so are any of these actions by Trump impeachable should the Democrats take over the Congress after the next midterm elections? Or would he be protected from impeachment by the immunity clause?
Well, so I think the immunity clause is different than the impeachment clause. And so Congress would retain the power to impeach a president. It doesn't require it doesn't require a legal finding that a crime was committed. In terms of what the Democrats would do, I think the first step and what I think we would want to see is just, we haven't even had oversight hearings. We haven't even had the basic factual gathering of what's been happening that would be an essential first step to ensuring that there's some kind of meaningful checks and balances. So I think that's the first thing we would want to see happen with a new Congress.
Okay. Alicia Bannon, Director of the Judiciary Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Thank you so much for joining us this morning on What's at Stake.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up next, how to talk to your son about fascism. And is it possible to de-radicalize a youngster? Craig A. Johnson has the blueprint. Stay with us. Back in a moment.
Peace. This is your social justice calendar for the week of June the 1st, 2025. On Friday, June the 6th, many will gather at the National Mall at 2 p.m. to defend the benefits and dignity that veterans deserve. For more information, please visit unitedforveterans.org. Also, Friday, June the 6th at 6 p.m., there will be Cuba, the U.S., and Global Solidarity. Conversations with Joanna Tablada, located at 450 K Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20001. More information can be found at busboysandpoets.com. On Saturday, June the 7th, from 1 to 3 p.m., join, protest, and confront Maersky supply chain and demand an end to corporate complicity in Israeli military aggression and human rights violations at the intersection of Hampton Boulevard and Terminal Boulevard, Norfolk, Virginia. For more information, visit at DMVPYN. WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. Thank you for supporting WPFW in keeping it alive and operating. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar helps to build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, in the 2024 election, for the first time, millennials and Gen Z, that is people born between 1981 and 2006, made up a large number of the electorate, and their drift towards Donald Trump shaped the outcome. Young, mostly white males who make up a large part of the Gen Z population helped to usher Trump into his second term. Trump's message has a special appeal to young white males. I guess you could say they know a fascist when they see one. Craig A. Johnson is an independent journalist and an academic who hosts the podcast 15 Minutes of Fascism. He's written a book titled How to Talk to Your Son About Fascism. Good morning, Craig A. Johnson, and welcome to What's at Stake.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, In my intro, I said, takes one to know one. What's the definition of a fascist? And is Trump a fascist in your opinion?
I don't know if Trump himself is a fascist. I don't know if he believes in much of anything. I think that the truth is that his movement, his political coalition has fascists in it. And he's the first American president in a very long time to directly appeal to fascists. I think that the easiest way to think about fascism is to think about what fascists do that most conservatives don't do. This is partly related to something that you were talking about in the earlier part of the hour. Donald Trump doesn't follow the rules, right? Fascists don't follow the rules. They don't play by the normal rules of the game. One of the biggest rules that they don't play by is nonviolence. Normally, in most political systems, the idea is that you don't kill or attack your political enemies. Fascists want violence. They want to be violent. They think that violence is good. They think that it's good to be violent. They think that it's good for a society, for people to be violent. And that's one of the big hallmarks of fascism.
So that's been demonstrated throughout history?
Yes, yes. That's something that was the case back in the early 20th century when fascism was founded. So, you know, Mussolini's fascist party was a party of veterans, veterans of World War I. And they thought that their experience in the war, the violence that sort of like gave birth to this new kind of person, which is what they consider themselves to be, they thought that that demanded a new political system, a new political expression. And that's what fascism was. Before Mussolini landed on the word fascism to describe his movement, he called it a trenchocracy, ruled by the people who had lived in the trenches. So fascists always think about themselves as being like born in battle, even if that battle was done, you know, in some arguing online forum, you know, in a chair on their computer.
Mm. So you said earlier, you don't think that Trump really, you don't know what he believes in. He doesn't know what he believes in. But do you see any indications of violence? We see definitely that he is vengeful. He seeks revenge against people perceived to be his enemies, political enemies, et cetera. Have you seen any indications of him leaning towards the violent aspect of fascism?
Oh, certainly. Trump's administration is using violence and oppression to attack its political enemies in a way that is a little bit different than what we've seen so far in the United States. And he's certainly laying the groundwork for something worse. The kinds of politicized deportations that we've seen under the Trump administration, that's something pretty different from what we've seen in the United States, at least in the last couple decades. You know, it's not since World War II that people have been like politicized en masse and you know, potentially imprisoned en masse for just like dissenting to something. That's something that's quite different. Trump's movement, the people who support him, they're very much willing to use violence. You know, the Proud Boys, people that Trump pointed out specifically during his speeches on the campaign trail in 2024, also people like the Patriot Front, and the violence that we saw at the Unite the Right rally in 2017. These are all perfect examples of the kinds of violence that fascism doesn't just sort of allow, it actually supports it, it demands it.
And let's not forget January 6th.
Yes.
Trump's message during the campaign was that he was going to make America great again, bring down the prices of eggs and gasoline and deport all the illegal immigrants. What part of that message appeals to young white men?
So young white men in the United States, and this is just because young white men in the United States belong to, you know, the political, social, economic group that's the most privileged. In a different country, it would be different people. But in the United States, we're talking about mostly cis, mostly straight, young white men. It appeals to them because they look at the world and accurately assess that, you know, they were promised a bill of goods. The world is not going to be as good or as just or as free. They're not going to have the same opportunities that their parents had. You know, the economy is worse. The planet is dying. They know this. We all know it too. The issue is that there is no answer to these problems. You know, there is no big mainstream answer to try to solve any of these problems for them. And so the right wing comes in and says, I have a solution to this problem. We need to return. You know, they pretend that they can go back to a time when these young, cis, straight, white men were in charge.
What do you mean by cis?
Oh, cisgender. So not people who are not trans.
Oh, okay. So people who are not trans, so heterosexuals.
People who are, you know, they're straight, so they're heterosexual, and they are not trans. So they're cisgendered.
Okay. So go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, no. No worries. So those folks, they look at the world and they see that it is not going to give back to them what they expected. You know, not only are they not going to be in charge, but they're downwardly mobile. They're going to be less wealthy. They're going to have less power than their parents did. Mm-hmm. And that's a hard thing to tell, you know, a teenager, is that like, that's what your life's going to be. Some mm-hmm. sort of like afterthought in history. That's mm-hmm. what they think. Mm-hmm. And so they look into historical examples of times when people like them have been the most powerful. And they imagine that that's the 1950s in the United States, totally forgetting that that was because of big union power, that that was why the working class and the middle class were doing so well in the United States in the 1950s. And, you know, that that was isolated to mostly heterosexual white couples. But that's what they imagine. They want to go back to that time. They want to go back to that past. And so that's what Trumpism appeals to in them, is that the idea that you can turn back the clock, go back in time, and return to some sort of imagined better past.
Mm-hmm. I mean, well, the present for them is, as you say, drastically different because you have people of color and women assuming more positions. The playing field has been equalized, and now they're able to participate at the same level, and so it makes it more competitive for the young white males. So let me ask you this, Craig A. Johnson. How are these young white men drawn into Trump's message? Because oftentimes college students are introduced through Republican chapters on campus or speakers that are scheduled to address the students. But that's really just a smaller segment of the Gen Z population. Describe the other ways they are introduced to these right-wing concepts.
Yeah, so here we're not just talking about Gen Z, we're also talking about the younger kids, you know, Gen Alpha, people who are at this point somewhere between, you know, 10 and 18. Those folks get their politics from the internet. They get it from TikTok, they get it from Instagram, they get it from smaller and weirder social media outlets that are frankly too creepy to be named. They get their information, they get their politics from there. And this is part of a long-standing effort by people on the right wing, starting back in the 2010s, to try to capture the younger generation of American voters and American influencers and American political operatives. They started back in the 2010s saying, like, we need to create an online culture of the right wing that appears to be just a bunch of memes, just a bunch of jokes, just a bunch of funny stuff that you can share with your friends. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then you show it to your mom and she says, oh, well, that's a racist joke, or, oh, that's a sexist joke. And the idea there, their intention, was that when a young person sees this thing, laughs at it, and then has their parent tell them that they're not supposed to laugh at that, that then they see themselves as being oppressed. They think that their ideas are being suppressed. They're not allowed to think something. And then suddenly they think of themselves as the victim. And this is what the right wing does for young, straight, white men, right? It allows them to think of themselves as the victim of society. You know, feminism is oppressing me, they say. You know, DEI is oppressing me, they say. All of that comes from this kind of culture.
Mm. So you have this chart in your book on page 69 where you show how a fitness influencer on the internet talks about dating advice. And that kind of leads to a discussion about male supremacism, and then that leads to fascism. So yeah. That's how it works. They pull them in, like you said, on a joke or something, or they take influencers. Tell us about that system.
Absolutely. So a lot of what the right wing does now is they use jokes or other kinds of content as a form of Trojan horse. Right. So just like you said in the example that I present in the book, let's say your son is interested in bodybuilding. Perfectly fine, totally normal thing that a young person might be interested in. Maybe he's interested in basketball. Maybe he wants to learn how to dunk. Maybe he wants to learn how to deadlift well, whatever. He goes online and he looks for a video on YouTube or on TikTok or Instagram or wherever to show him how to do it well. And he sees this video and it's this influencer guy and he's all buff and cool and he shows him how to do it. Okay, so now the kid trusts this guy. Maybe he sees some more of his videos. Well, what else is that guy likely to be talking about? For a lot of these influencers, yeah, they're basically only going to be talking about, you know, fitness or about something like that. But some of them will start talking about other things too. Suddenly they'll start talking about, like, well, why do you want to get fit? Well, they assume that it's because you want to date people. And then that leads directly into misogynist discussions about how to get women to date you, assuming that women need to be manipulated in order to date people, making very sexist and gendered assumptions about what people want or what people are like. That leads them to start talking about, you know, gender roles and tradition and society and why people are dating fewer people and why the birth rate is declining. Well, now they're talking about where the birth rate is declining. Now they're talking about race. You know, now they're talking about the so-called replacement theory. And there is just a straight line between some of these, you know, fitness influencer people and actual fascist, racist content. It's really disturbing. Some of these are coming from the same outlets. You know, it's the same guy teaching you how to deadlift who's talking about supposed great replacement. But in other cases, it's just the algorithm. The algorithm is like, oh, well, you like this fitness influencer. Maybe you'll like to watch this other guy who's also really popular, and he happens to be a Nazi.
Okay, so we see how they're drawn in to this web. So it's almost impossible for parents to prevent their 10-year-olds from being drawn into that unless they completely monitor and access their viewing habits on the internet. I mean, you would think it would be okay to tune into a guy that's teaching about fitness or fashion in some case. So some of these self-radicalized recruits, can radicalized recruits be unradicalized? And if so, how?
I would say definitely. I would also disagree with you that parents can't do anything to prevent this from happening. It's true that you can't do anything to prevent your kid from seeing this kind of messaging. They are going to see it. It's just in the air right now. They are going to see it. And so what you need to do is to get out ahead of it. You know, you need to vaccinate them against it, basically. You need to be the one to talk to them about it. In the same way that a responsible parent would step up and say and talk to their kid about sexual health, or in the same way that a responsible parent would step up and talk to their kid about the dangers of racism, about the dangers of sexism, or rape culture. In exactly the same way, you need to get out ahead and say, okay, you're gonna be seeing this kind of messaging. Whether you see it on your phone, your friend might share a meme with you. This is what it's gonna look like. It's not gonna sound like, you know, the Nazis that you read about in your school book. It's not gonna have a swastika on it. It's not gonna openly say, you know, I'm a white supremacist. It's not gonna say that. It's going to couch it in terms that will seem nice, will seem inviting. You have to tell them, like, you have to be careful. You have to watch out for these things. If you see something and somebody is saying something and you're confused about it, tell me. Like, you don't have to be embarrassed to show me. You don't have to be embarrassed to ask me about it. You don't have to be embarrassed to be confused about it or even to like some of it, because it's designed for them to like it, you know? You have to present yourself as a parent, as an educator, you know, as a member of a faith community, as a neighbor, anybody who is a trusted adult in a young person's life. You have to present yourself as a safe person to talk to in these contexts, even if it's about something that's hard.
So what age do you think you should have that talk with your son about fascism? You know, with the sex things that I've seen fathers get out the banana in a condom, you know, so, but you can't really do that with this kind of a conversation. Number one, the parent has to be informed about all this. And I guess that's where they get your book.
That's the hope. Yeah.
It's not about fascism. Go ahead.
Just to answer the age question, the book is, primarily aimed at people who are dealing with young men ages 10 to 24, 10 to 25, basically. But when it comes to when they're going to see this messaging, it's as soon as they're in charge of their own phone or tablet.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's when you need to start to have the talk about fascism. So yeah. Now, what's the worst thing a parent or teacher or, you know, trusted person can do to try to educate or de-radicalize a right-wing son? I saw one TikTok where the father cut his two sons off financially altogether. They were older because they voted for Trump against the father's commands and wishes.
That's a tough one. I mean, by the time that they're voting age, they're adults. And so your level of influence over them is a lot smaller than it used to be. You have to sort of balance there between being a parent and being the sort of person who, you know, is an adult holding another adult to account. You know, I can't blame somebody for saying, hey, I don't want to be your friend. I don't want to hang out. I don't want to get together. I don't want you to come to my house for Thanksgiving if you voted for Trump. I think that's understandable. But when we're dealing with a child, right? When we're dealing with somebody who's 10 to 18, then you have to step up and understand that they're your responsibility in a lot of ways, right? If you cut them off, if you shut them out of your life, and they're falling down this rabbit hole, that is the only place they have left to go. If you shut them down and you say, like, you know, I don't want to hear any of that. I don't want you to talk about this. I don't want to discuss it. I don't want this in my house. Get out. Well, where do you think they're going to go? They're going to go toward the right wing. The right wing prepares them for this. It assumes that they will get shut down and hurt and kicked out of their family. It tells them that that's what's going to happen. And so the thing that you have to do, and it's the hardest thing in the world, and it's frankly, it's hard for me to ask people to do this, but the thing that you have to do is you have to show some empathy. You have to say to yourself, this is a young person. They are being manipulated. They don't fully understand what's happening. They can't. They're young. Their brain doesn't work the way that an adult's brain works, literally, right? You know, they can't think about long-term patterns. They can't think about big consequences. They're just not wired to do it. I need to help them. And so you need to show up with empathy. You need to show up with kindness and care. You need to say, hey, I don't agree with that. I don't want to hear about it, but, you know, I still love you. If you acknowledge that you made a mistake, if you acknowledge that you messed up, you can come back into my community. But, you know, you have to hold space for that.
So what about young Black men? Because they're the young Black fascists falling down the right-wing rabbit hole as well. Some Black men, not many, but some voted for Trump, and other Blacks found it hard to believe why they would do so. Your thoughts about that, Craig A. Johnson?
Yeah, this is part of a bigger, complicated question about why people who are not white support white supremacist policies sometimes. You know, this was the case in 2024, right? There were a number of Black voters who voted for Trump. Trump won Latino men by a teensy margin, I believe. And it's confusing, you know, but I think that part of this has to be the same answer as, you know, we ask ourselves, like, okay, well, why did my union steelworker uncle vote for Trump, right? That's against his interests too. People don't vote based upon their own material interests all the time. Sometimes they get caught up with an ideology that maybe is shiny and new and exciting. Fascism is new and exciting for a lot of people. It has a lot of vigor and power. You know, that's how it presents itself. Another real way that fascism captures young men, independent of their race, is by sex and gender. Is that one of fascism's fundamental aspects is that it is gender segregating, it's sexist. And so it captures a lot of young men's interest, partly because of sexism, independent of its racism. I would even argue that historically, that the thing that ties most fascists together is their sexism and gender. There have been a fair number of fascist organizations that are not organized about race, but they're all organized around gender.
And so what about the Barack Obama factor? Are you seeing some backlash or something that may have helped to talk about that a little bit?
Oh, absolutely. I think that Trump's success, if there is a single word to define Trump's success or to explain it, it probably is Obama. When it comes to that, I think that there's a lot of young men who were maybe already leaning right or were interested in it or susceptible to it, who look at Obama's success as an example of a, in their minds, you know, undeserving success, right? Like, obviously, this is ridiculous. You know, Barack Obama is one of the most singularly qualified presidential candidates in the, you know, the last 100 years. But to them, any person who holds power who is not a straight white man is undeserving. That's what they think. And so they look at Obama's success and they think that that means that he's undeserving. The same holds for Kamala Harris.
So the sexism part of the fascist message, what about talking to your daughters about becoming fascist? And briefly, we're down to the last minute.
Yeah, for young women, it's mostly a warning. You know, it's the same thing that you say when you're warning a young woman about the dangers of rape culture. You have to say, this messaging is coming for you. Some of your friends might see it and say it. You have to trust them to tell you when they're feeling unsafe. and to trust you to be a person that they can come to and believe them when they say that something's happening.
So you should say, have the same talk with your daughter about fascism? Yeah. Okay.
Oh, yes.
Craig A. Johnson, author of How to Talk to Your Son About Fascism. So basically, thank you so much, Craig, for being our guest this morning on What's at Stake.
Thank you so very much. It was lovely to talk.
So that's going to do it for this week's edition of What's at Stake. Thanks to our guests, Attorney Alicia Bannon, Director of the Judiciary Program at the Brennan Center, and Craig A. Johnson, author of How to Talk to Your Son About Fascism. A special thanks to Judge Robert Gordon for assistance with the legal segment. Michael Nasella is our engineer par excellence. And thanks to you, the listener, for tuning in. Next week, the Reverend Mark Thompson will be in the host seat. Up next, Dr. E. Faye Williams and Wake Up and Stay Woke. I'm Verna Avery Brown, and in the words of the late Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it's done. Be well.
Freedom! June is Caribbean American Heritage Month. Thus, CAWI, CPN, ICS, AFI, and Africa World Art Project present the 23rd DC Caribbean Film Fest, June 6th to June 12th at AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center in downtown Silver Spring. The festival showcases the best in Caribbean cinema with films such as the U.S. premiere of Fanon and more. The DC Caribbean Film Fest, June 6th to June 12th. Information at afi.com/silver or 301-495-6700. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
To get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support jazz and justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
Greetings. This is Papa Wabe inviting you to check out my new showgram, Free Your Mind with Papa Wabe, every Thursday morning from 2 to 5 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We present a mashup of positive, uplifting music of different genres, mainly roots reggae. We also feature poetry, speeches, artist interviews, and so much more. That's Free Your Mind with Papa Wabe, Thursday mornings, 2 to 5 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, here on WPFW 89.3 FM, making it a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Free your mind!
Say bless, say bless, say bless!
Yeah!
Thank you, family. We're so grateful for each and every one of you who made a pledge during our spring membership drive. Though we didn't quite reach the finish line, your love, presence, your belief in WPFW, they remind us that this station is more than radio. It's a rhythm, a refuge, a revolution. We trust you'll keep walking with us, dancing with us, building with us, because this community-powered radio station rises with you and only with you. Thank you for keeping the beat alive.
We rest in the city. We rest in the
city. WPFW, in collaboration with the Josephine Butler Center, present the Jazz and Justice Festival, Sunday, June 22nd, noon until 8 p.m. An activation of music, poetry, social justice teach-ins, visual art, wellness, children's activities, and more in Malcolm X Park. WPFW personalities Saiz Kamaluddin, Kaaba Soul Singer, and Proverbs Reggae Band will be among the performers, with sets by DJ Lance Reynolds and Underdog. Also featured will be an art show curated by Adrian Ferguson of The Art of Noise and a community curated by Milani Douglas. Stay tuned to WPFW for updates and details.
Hi, I'm Robin Holden.
Hi, I'm Miyuki Williams.
WPFW and Parks and People invite you to the Jazz and Justice Festival, Sunday, June 22nd, from 12 noon until 8 p.m. at Malcolm X Park.
It's a family-friendly celebration of culture, community, and resistance during the week of Juneteenth and the summer solstice.
Experience the power of WPFW's on-air voices brought to life with featured speakers Anthony Browder and Reverend Lennox Yearwood.
Live performances by Saiz Kamaluddin, Kaba, and Proverbs, plus DJ Lance Reynolds and Underdog, keeping the vibe alive.
Connect in the community, led by Milani Douglas. Explore art curated by Adrian Ferguson and enjoy intergenerational fun.